Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello again. We're here this week with Belden Johnson. Belden is a therapist and the author of a new book entitled Real Relationship, Essential Tools to Help You Go the Distance. Interesting subtitle. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Emma. Glad to be here.
What led you to come up with that title?
The title, as all titles, as you know, goes through various permutations. It started off as the Lover's Guidebook. And as I was writing it, I realized that what I'm really talking about is what makes a relationship real, as opposed to the illusory ones that we tend to inhabit in our culture, in which we believe that the feelings and songs and movies of the romantic stage, which inform us, are what love is supposed to be. And that is but one aspect of love, and a very difficult one to maintain for a long run.
I was just listening to Terry Gross interviewing Donna Summers, who...
I was too.
Was just...
I love to love you, baby.
I don't know how she hits that.
But that was that's what we were sold. That's what it's supposed to be, and that's how it's supposed to stay, isn't it?
Yep, that's the way my mama always told me it was supposed to be.
But then it turns out to not be that way.
It turns out a very different experience.
Mm-hmm. What makes relationships so challenging for?
Well, I think that's a good question, because relationships in the romantic stage are fairly easy. And then as we get past about the 2 or 3 year mark, they become more difficult and very challenging. In the romantic stage, we're surging with a chemical cocktail comprised of a variety of things with very long names, like phenylethylamide, dopamine, norepinephrine, vasopressin, oxytocin.
Stop, you're getting me excited.
And it is very exciting. And when our brains and bodies are surging with this chemical cocktail, we lose our critical faculty. And it doesn't matter to us that our loved one is a serial killer or even uses the wrong fork. That what we will tend to do is to just think, gosh, isn't she or he sweet? I just enjoy the way he picks his nose. And those things don't bother us, and we're euphoric, we're walking on air. And of course, we want to write poems and sing songs and celebrate this amazing experience, which is, as some researchers are now pointing out, is also a tremendously addictive one.
Mm-hmm.
And that we experience a lot of the same elements of addiction that would happen with cocaine or heroin or many other drugs. So as that occurs, things are easy. And then somewhere along around 2 years, and this time varies depending on the person and how many times they've been through this, it tends to abbreviate the more times we go through it. The love cocktail starts to deplete, and simultaneously with that, a lot of archaic feelings, by which I mean feelings from families of origin and childhood, start to ascend in the relationship. And then we have our issues.
The reptiles come out.
The reptiles occur. And then we have two large Tyrannosaurus Rexes trying to inhabit the same household. And we find each other extremely annoying, and we wondered how in the heck we could have fallen in love with this person in the first place. And so in my office, what I'll hear a lot, I'll hear people coming in, and they'll say these very sad words over and again, which is, I think we should separate. I love him, but we're not in love anymore. We're not in love anymore. And they make that distinction.
That's almost been like the refrain. I've heard that so many, and really in the last 10 years, mm-hmm. people have been just saying that, oh, I really, really love her, but I'm not in love with her.
Exactly. So what they're attempting to distinguish is the fact that, yeah, there is a caring here, and I know this is a good person, but I've run out of the love cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the things that makes relationships difficult. In actuality, there are many, many challenges to long-term relations as opposed to short-term relations. And I think they can be assigned to about four categories, the physical, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual.
And all of those aren't really very important when you're in that first phase, which is always seems to me it's kind of like the mating dance when the peacock spreads the feathers and these incredible birds that clean up this whole area in the woods mm-hmm. and build a nest, and the female comes along, and if she gets excited by that nest, then they do this mating dance and they're entranced by it, and it's beautiful, and it's when all the colors show. But then they get down to the real work of, okay, let's lay the eggs and let's feed the babies, and they don't seem to do as human beings do, which say, hey, you know, I want to go do another mating dance.
Well, actually they do. Although some birds mate for life, great geese mm-hmm. are one example, only 3% of mammals mate for life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are caught in a contradiction between the part of us that is genetically and biochemically engineered by evolution to do what you're talking about, to go through mm-hmm. the mating dance, to have this exciting connection, to have that lasts about long enough, as evolutionary anthropologists have pointed out, like Helen Fisher and Sarah Ritty, who have done groundbreaking work in this, that it's about long enough for us to have a lot of sex, conceive a child, and raise that child to the point at which the mother doesn't have to carry it anymore. And so once the mother's arms are free to go back to hunting and gathering, if we think of this back on the Serengeti Plain,
mm-hmm.
She no longer needs the male protector. And what occurs, according to these theories, is that then both people sort of fall out of love, in the sense that they're no longer bonded by the chemical cocktail. There still may be a lot of caring, but in point of fact, what happens is that they say, wow, this gal looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start philandering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has evolutionary benefits because mm-hmm. Sure. First of all, the genes get spread out mm-hmm. among more than one couple.
Mm-hmm.
So as the genes are spread, our DNA is more likely to survive. So we can look at this and think that we've really come from a long line of successful philanderers.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, however, if you're having a nice relationship with a new person across at the other cave, but when you bring back the wildebeest steaks, you still drop off a few of them mm-hmm. for the old family.
Mm-hmm.
And so what in fact happens is then children and families are supported by more than one provider. The genes tend to proliferate, and the hypothesis is that is one of the programmings that we have for a successful expression of DNA through the ages. Now, I think it's really important to understand this because so many people believe that they should have this romantic love and make it last for centuries. But on the other hand, what in fact occurs is that it is not going to get the chemical boost that it has in the beginning. And so people then feel very guilty and very bad about the fact that, my goodness, I know I'm with this really good person, but I just don't have the in-love feeling, and I'm starting to feel this in-love feeling for this person at work or that I've met at the gym or whatever. And they're consumed by guilt about this, and they don't understand the process. And then they feel very, very badly when they enter into serially monogamous relationships, which, as we observe our culture, that's exactly what happens.
Well, I feel much better already.
Well, it made me feel much better, I'll tell you, because as a young man, I found that I would have about 18-month relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know this is a wonderful person that I'm with, but I'm starting just to lose that passion, and boy, this other woman looks really, really good to me. Oh my gosh, what do I do now? So that led me to start looking at what's the reality here as opposed to our illusion. And if we choose to have long-term relationships, how can we bring that about, or can we bring that about in a way that provides an alternative possibility to the 3 or 4 year relationship cycle? In romantic love cultures, most divorces occur at 4 years. The 7 year itch is a myth. It's a 4 year itch. And that's when the vast majority of people divorce, is at 4 years. There's a huge spike at that point. They've run out of love cocktail, and there's no place for them to go at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought that after the love cocktail waned, you still had a good deal of your dopamine left, and that would keep you going for a while, and then your oxytocin's supposed to kick in, and you make this deep commitment.
Excellent point. And oxytocin, the mother-child bonding hormone, also occurs between lovers, and it's particularly sparked by skin-to-skin contact. And so for a lot of my couples who are in distress, I tell them to shut up and stop trying to solve everything verbally and just to sit down on the couch and watch a romantic flick together and cuddle. And what happens is the cells, there's a cellular communication at that point, and there's an oxytocin release, and then they start feeling very fondly toward each other. The problem is, Emmett, that oxytocin ain't the same thing as a huge shot of dopamine and norepinephrine, and then that gets spiked up a little bit more if you're in a adulterous relationship with adrenaline, because it's so dangerous. And so people have this extreme high that is very dramatic, and that so that makes an adulterous relationship particularly challenging to overcome.
Might as well face it, I'm addicted to love. How real, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And
so we're in trouble.
We are in trouble. And I think that we need to recognize this, first of all, to become conscious of this. There's a certain liberation in having the actual facts of what happens to us biochemically. And then to make an important decision. And that decision is, shall we... do we want to go through revolving door relationships and simply go, okay, well, this is the way we're programmed, 4 years ain't a bad run with somebody, and then when we get to that point where we're starting to not be in love, in quotes, anymore, maybe we'll try something else and decide to part amicably and have a new relationship. Now, that... In fact, as we look around, that's what 50% of the marriages are doing. they are, except they're not parting amicably, they're parting with a lot of rancor and bitterness, and end up hating each other because they don't understand what's really going on. And they attribute it to all sorts of other things, that you know, this person that I thought was God's gift to the universe now looks like Satan to me. And there's that huge shift around.
Right. It's when the reptiles have come out, when your family of origin issues start to make it to the surface, and you start interpreting what's coming at you from your partner, and
in terms of your own worldview,
and
in terms of what you believe is happening, and you're not really checking it out with the other person.
And of course, you can't let yourself know that it's really you who are, quote, backing out of the relationship. It's you who are finding the person at work so attractive, and she and my wife doesn't understand me.
Those are the famous words, of course. So your point about the reptilian brain is an important one, because what also occurs in at this point in time is that as people start to realize that, gosh, we are kind of different. In the romantic stage, we're just amazing because we realize we're the only two people in the world who both like the Beatles and Dostoevsky or whatever.
Right.
And then all of a sudden we find out, my God, we're so different. I can't believe you're actually going to vote for that guy. I can't believe you must not have a brain in your head. And then there's an enormous amount of bickering and calling each other names, a loss of civility. And what happens is we literally blow off the neocortex. We lose the neocortex and we get down into the reptilian brain, and we're fighting for survival at a sort of I'm trying to save my ego from being destroyed in this relationship. And then it gets really, really ugly. And again, people don't understand what's happening. They just think, I didn't really know this person before. Now I see that he or she is really, I had rose-colored glasses, but now I'm seeing them clearly. In fact, what's happened is you've swung to the opposite polarity, and you're seeing some of the negative qualities of this person, but you're also seeing a whole lot of your own history. And you're perceiving this person now in terms of your family of origin issues, which then erupt. And most people don't realize that's what's happening. They don't have a consciousness at that point that I'm looking at you and I'm seeing my daddy, who was cold and rejecting, and when I gave him my first novel, he fell asleep after the first page and didn't want to read it or whatever. Now I'm perceiving my wife as not being interested in me. So I'll give you a wonderful example of this from Yashi and my relationship. Yashi Johnson's my lovely wife, as you know.
For more than 4 years, I hear.
For more than 4 years, yeah. We're 25 and counting now, so that's happy. So I know this works. When Yashi would come back from her weekend away working in Fresno, I would be working, I would be at hard at work writing. And I was thinking, well, this is fine. I'm not really missing her. I'm having time just to work. And in fact, what was really going on with me was an old family of origin issue, which was feeling abandoned and that I had to self-soothe, as the modern phrase is. And I got very good at that, at being independent and self-soothing and taking care of myself and shutting out mommy. So actually, when my mother left me with my dad, who'd just come back from the war, for a week, and she came back, and we met her at Union Station in Washington, D.C. I said, okay, we had sat there at the cafe and had hot chocolate. And I was being very cold to my mother. And I said, I have to go to the bathroom. And she said, well, I'll take you. I said, no, I'm a big boy now. I was 3 at the time. I'm a big boy now. I go to the men's room with my father. So here I am doing this. I'm at the men's room with my father here, writing the great American novel or whatever. And Yashi comes barreling in. Now, Yashi is terrified as she comes home because she's thinking, is my husband going to treat me in the same way that my mother treated me when I came home from school? And my mother, who didn't like me very much, responded by, are you here already? And Yashi would feel crushed and hurt by this lack of love. So Yashi's expecting that welcome. She comes in the door. And she says, Belden? I said, just a minute, honey, let me finish this paragraph.
All right.
And at first, she would just burst into tears.
Ooh.
And she would be crushed. And I'd go, what's wrong? This woman's crazy. She's nuts. I mean, I told her I'd be there in a minute or two. What's happening? Well, fortunately, we had done enough of our own work to understand the underpinnings that I've just described here. Many couples this will happen to, and they think it's totally happening in the present. And a good rule of thumb is that 20% of our relationships happen in the present, and 80% are happening in the past. So we realized something was going on. We went through the feelings on it and got in touch with this stuff, number one, and worked through some of the hard feelings, and then we amended it with a correction. And I'm very proud of this correction. Yeah, she says it's one of my two great contributions to the field of marital and family therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I call it take two. And so even though we understood perfectly what was happening, it would still happen. I find that fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
We could cognitively understand it, but it would still trigger our old stuff. So Yashi's going, my mother doesn't love me, she doesn't really want me here, and I'm going, I'm not going to show this rejecting woman who's just abandoned me for 3 days any love. I'm perfectly okay of taking care of myself. So what we found is that the way to break it was to begin the scene again as we would in Hollywood, take two. So we'd stop it and say, okay, let's try it again. Go back outside. So Yashi would literally go out the door, and then she would come in and say, honey, I'm home. And I would say, oh, I'm so glad to see you. It's so wonderful. I've missed you so much. This is great. And we would embrace, and it would all be better.
Yeah.
Instantly.
Yeah.
Just with that simple correct.
Yeah, we've done that. We've done the same thing. We learned that trick. It's a great trick.
It's a great trick.
Take two. Everybody knows what it means. Yep. The scene stops, camera's off. Okay, everything that just happened didn't happen. You go outside and do it right. It's so easy to let it go when you do that.
Exactly. But it requires the understanding of what's happening. The feelings have to be mitigated enough so that you're actually able to have enough neocortex home, so you're not a Tyrannosaurus Rex, but you can have enough a neocortex to think, oh, wait a minute, I know what's happening, we need to start this over from the top. And that, in a nutshell, is one of the ways that we can overcome the emotional difficulties that will arise in our long-term relationship.
This is Dr. Emmett Miller, and you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Today's guest is Belden Johnson, and we're discussing his most recent book, Real Relationship, Essential Tools to Help You Go the Distance. And we've just talked about one of the tools. Give us some more.
Well, obviously another issue that we alluded to earlier, Emmett, was the kind of cultural brainwashing that we're subjected to, that we get fed as we grow up. And we're surrounded by a plethora of information about love, which is all pretty much romantic love. And so we begin those with little fairy tales when we're children, in which the prince and the princess meet and live happily ever after. And then as teenagers, we begin hearing, once for every boy and girl, there's just one love in this whole world and I, anyway. And all of those songs that that teach us, mm-hmm. and movies and so and everything else that's around us, that teach us that what love is about is finding that one other soulmate with whom we will live happily ever after with minimal problem, because if we have issues, we will simply talk about them rationally and work them out. So given this kind of roadmap for our relationships, we're in deep doo-doo,
mm-hmm.
because that is only going to happen during the romantic love phase of our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So a really, really important examination is to look very carefully at our assumptive system. And what kind of beliefs do I have,
mm-hmm.
about love and relationship? And let me subject these, let us as a coupleship, or as an individual, you can do it, mm-hmm. either way. Let me subject this to some rigorous scrutiny. For instance, let's take one of the standard myths that there is a soulmate and that we need to find him or her, and then we will be blissfully happy, and that there's only one. So the rubric that I like to apply to this, it asks three questions. And the first question is this absolutely true?
Mm-hmm.
Do I know for scientific fact that this is absolutely true, that for each person in the world there's only one other?
And of course there's quite a profusion of evidence to the contrary.
There's an enormous amount of evidence to the contrary, and I'm here to tell you, having had several soulmates in my lifetime, that that we probably have somewhere around 1 million possibilities on,
mm-hmm.
the face of the earth,
mm-hmm.
that we're going to trigger that romantic connection with. So the odds are very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is when I believe this, how do I feel in my body? So, well, when I believe it and I'm in a relationship with this person, I feel really, really good. And then at the point at which that relationship runs into issues, I feel terrible. And I feel so badly that, as we know, I may not only feel awful and get extremely depressed over lost love, but I may become a stalker, or I may kill myself, or I may kill my loved one.
Mm-hmm.
This the greatest number of murders of women are by males who say they love them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an extremely dangerous situation to be in.
And in most cases, it doesn't get that bad, though.
In most cases, it doesn't get that bad.
What's a milder form?
But it can be a milder form of it, such as, I'm just miserable at this point in my relationship. I don't know why. I'm just miserable. It's just not what I expected it to be, and I don't feel good. And what's wrong here? So the chemical reversal at that point is so dramatic that people, it's one of the worst feelings in life. So,
mm-hmm.
one of the best feelings that we can have in life, which is to fall in love with somebody,
mm-hmm.
high,
mm-hmm.
is counterbalanced by one of the most awful feelings that we can have in life, which is feeling miserable over a lost love. And that requires a lot of amendment in order to deal with that. So we know that you can feel really good or really bad.
Mm-hmm.
The third question is then, how might I feel, and you use your imagination in this case, if I didn't believe this? What if I believe the alternative? What if I believe that I actually had many soulmates, or as one woman said to me, a lovely Anglo-Indian woman, she said, you know, there are more fish in the sea than ever came out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, right on, that's true. That if I believe this, then I know, rather than I've lost my one soulmate, there's nothing left for me to hope for, if I'm going, well, there are a lot of possibilities. And what we know is that the surest cure for a miserable love is to find a new one.
Mm-hmm.
As Mercutio says to Romeo, in Romeo and Juliet, when Romeo is so upset that he's lost the love of Diana, Mercutio says, come on, let's go to a party. Cast thy eyes on other beauties. And Romeo says, no, there'll be nobody. Nobody. Wow, who's that over there? Is that Juliet? My God, that's love at first sight. And he immediately forgets about Diana, mm-hmm. who has rejected him. And so I think that we really need to look at our expectations very carefully and to do this in a cognitive manner and to go, wait a minute, what's really true here? And how can I actually verify this rather than simply believing the fairy tales of my childhood? Because those are going to lead us to misery.
So now you've got me believing that I've got many soulmates, and so it's not surprising that things seem to be cooling off in my recent relationship. Where do I go from there?
That's the important question. And I think that there are many different approaches, and that's why I really wanted to write this book. Uh-huh. And that is the core of this book, is how can we make long-term relationship work effectively? So I think the first step, we hadn't mentioned the spiritual part. The spiritual part is that, as you know, in our culture, we tend to believe we are each separate individuals and we are not a part of the whole. Despite John Donne's poem that no man is an island, mm-hmm. That we all feel like we're islands and that we're cut off. And that as long as we have that belief that we are separate egos who are unconnected to everybody else and to the planet and to the cosmos, we are going to have what's called existential anxiety. We're going to be afraid of non-being. And we're going to be as scared as Jean-Paul Sartre was about that. Most of us have that, and one important cure is to be able to come through that and to be able to understand our connectivity with other people, relationships to other, to nature, our relationship to the larger cosmos. In order to do this, there are many different ways that people have achieved this over the centuries. But what I devised about 35 years ago now, God, has it been that long? I started taking clients out into nature on a vision quest and to take people up into some beautiful country where they can spend 2 days and two nights alone out in the wilderness. And what happens, of course, at first is people are very terrified to be alone at all and to be alone in the wilderness because we think that there are going to be grizzly bears eating us up and snakes coming into our sleeping bags and so forth. What tends to happen for most people in this process is that they get a huge surge of fear, especially on the first night as it gets dark. And when they find that they actually live through the night and they watch Father Sun come up in the morning, they have a revelatory experience and they understand why nature peoples have worshipped the sun all over the world for many, many, many centuries. And then the second day, they start getting really comfortable. They find by the second night, they're pretty comfortable. And they realize their connectivity to the whole. When that occurs, the fear of non-being and death drops away. And the openness to love and to other people, to many, many other people, opens up for them. It's almost a magical curative experience. And it's a two-part, again, and this you'll hear this over and again or read this in my book over and again. It's two parts. It's not just having the corrective experience. It's dealing with the feelings first. We have to deal with the feeling part first. Then we can have the wonderful corrective experience. Mm-hmm. So to the degree that they can really feel their fear, and I encourage them to to shout, get it all out, scream with it, yell, I'm afraid. We only mm-hmm. come to help them if they say Mayday.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they can say whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And people are around the lake, a lot of them may be screaming, I'm terror scared, I'm so scared, mm-hmm. I'm so scared. Yeah, that's a part of being human, as we are in this culture. So that is a really important corrective experience on the spiritual end. Moving backward through our categories then, on the mental end, I've talked already about being able to examine our beliefs critically when we're not overcome with the love cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And to go, here's the reality. Now let me, how do I want to adapt to this reality? And to make a really conscious choice of that. If our conscious choice is, I want to make a long-term relationship work, then there's some very specific ways to do that, most of which are in my book. I'm only going to be able to touch on a couple in the time that we have available. Foremost among those is shedding the illusions and the pretense that can often happen in the early part of a relationship, in which we want someone to love us, we put our best foot forward, and we say, okay, I'm not gonna bring up the fact that I really want to go and play golf. And we'll see people who were avid golfers, for instance, they don't play golf for a year or two. And then they start getting irritated, and they blame it on their partner and say, well, I used to love golf, but you won't let me do it. And the guy says, well, I never said that. It's fine with me if you play golf. Really? No, I know you'll resent me for it. And so they have to work through these kinds of issues. They also have to work through these family of origin issues that I mentioned and gave the example of Yashi and me in the homecoming situation. We can only do this if we are totally truthful with each other. Now that is a huge mountain to climb for most of us who've been brought up in a culture that doesn't mind what are called little white lies, and in which we're surrounded by people who lie and politicians who lie.
Image is everything.
And it means dropping our image of ourselves and becoming the real person that we really are and being able to say, no, I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them in a box. I do not like them with a fox or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
No, and very brave couples are going to be able to say, look, I'm starting not to have that love cocktail with you anymore. And I'm starting to feel attracted to Susie Q over here at work. And most people hide that completely, and they would never say that. Now, when we hide it, it gets bigger mm-hmm. in us. Mm-hmm. And when we are able to share it with a partner and say, I'm telling you this because I want to stay with you and I don't want to be running off with Susie Q, then we now have a collaborative team which can work together after the initial feelings come up, which they probably will, and have to be worked through. That's often triggers a lot of feeling for the partner who's hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
And she or he has to be able to go through the feelings and understand, wow, this partner's giving me a tremendous gift by being this honest with me. And yeah, well, how do we organize around this? And so I've had couples who are, for instance, say, well, I'm going to change jobs. I'm not going to work at this job anymore because I don't want to jeopardize my relationship. And the way that we get unaddicted is by not being around our substance of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are, in fact, you know, we're just being friends, we're just going out to lunch, that will be a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
So people will often devise a plan to be cold turkey. One of my couples decided they were going to take their postponed honeymoon that they hadn't had when they'd gotten married and go to Hawaii for a month. Gabe put the kids with grandma, took off by themselves, fell back in love.
Mm-hmm.
A relaxed month in Hawaii away from Susie Q.
That's good.
And when they came back, they were so much in love again that was no longer a threat, and he, in fact, could stay on the job. It was he'd gotten past it at that point. So that's a brief synopsis of what we might do emotionally and with honesty, and I think also remembering that this is a sentient being. This is not our enemy. This is somebody that we know is a good person, that we've been with for many years, and we need to treat them kindly and compassionately. No matter what we're going through, we have to remember to treat them at least as well as we do our friends.
Mm-hmm.
Many couples do not, and they are extremely nasty to one another.
Yeah.
And that is a sure, treating each other with contempt is a sure way of absolutely sandbagging the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that we take a deep breath and go, yeah, I'm having a lot of feelings, and I'm going to treat you with the kind of respect, kindness, consideration, and compassion that I would like to be treated with.
Mm-hmm. And John Gottman talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You know, that first you get defensiveness, and after a while, you know, that begins to change. You begin to get your stonewalling, refusal to communicate, and just being resistant. And that goes on to being critical of your partner, and finally, contempt. As you go down that slippery slope, as he says, very seldom do you see a relationship that really recovers from the contempt level. So watching out for those kinds of attitudes in your relationship, and I think, as you said, you know, making a pledge to treat your at least formally addictively loved one with as much respect as you do your friends.
And when we do that, we trigger oxytocin with each other, and that brings us down to the physical level, in which we really want to find ways of manipulating through ourselves how we can manipulate the chemicals inside our bodies. And that's one example of when we treat each other kindly and we're willing to touch each other, that we can trigger oxytocin. We can trigger dopamine and adrenaline and norepinephrine by doing new things together, by novelty. And if we do the same old all the time, and we're always making love in that one position, or we're always going to the same restaurant for dinner, we get into ruts.
Mm-hmm.
And a simple thing as making a variation, even a minor variation, in our traditional day-to-day activities that we become enamored with, we love our routines. But it's really wonderful to, let's try this new restaurant that we've never been to before. Let's see what it might be like to go park and make out in the car like we did when we were 16, and see what happens in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to meet all of our policeman friends in that way. It's really wonderful.
And triggering the oxytocin?
The oxytocin is triggered best by physical contact.
Mm-hmm.
And this is you know, men have according to Helen Fisher, men are programmed in this way, that we have tended to lead the charge in saying, well, you know, let's make love and then we'll feel better. And there's a lot of truth in that. That in fact, if we can have if we can start having sexual connection, we trigger oxytocin. Now, most women, and again, we're generalizing wildly here, but most women I need face-to-face communication before I get in the mood. And the guys are going, okay, well, let's see if I can do that. So there has to be a understanding of our gender differences and a willingness on the part of men to be good listeners and communicators, and the willingness on the part of women to say, well, let's... Okay, I don't know if I feel like making love, but let's at least get naked and cuddle in bed and see what happens. And when those things start to happen, we start re-triggering massive amounts of all of the chemicals.
Hmm.
Not just oxytocin, but And I love this. Helen Fisher points out in Why We Love that that in sperm are all of these chemicals. In the male ejaculate, in addition to the sperm, are vasopressin, oxytocin, norepinephrine, the whole chemical cocktail. And then the woman receives this, and she goes, boy, I'm feeling a lot more loving now. After we had this connection, well, she's just gotten a big shot without a hypodermic. So if what we need to be able to do is to overcome consciously these blocks to our loving, and to really work with each other as a team collaboratively in order to bring that through. And we can do that.
And your book really really gives really presents some a strategy for being able to do that.
The whole purpose of the book is to bring this understanding about, number one, and then number two, to present a variety of strategies for making long-term relationship vivid and exciting and fulfilling for both people.
Why would anyone, I mean, since the love cocktail is so good, since you get so high, and there's certainly a lot of soulmates just waiting for you to give them a call, why bother to have a long-term relationship?
Well, I think that that is a valid question, and I think that each of us needs to really inform ourselves and to decide what we want to do. And at a certain point in my life, all I can do is speak for myself, but at a certain point in my life, I decided, you know what, I really want to have children. And I would really like these children to have a mother who's around for more than 3 years. And I would like to be in their lives for the rest of their lives. And also, you know, this hopping from person to person is getting a little tiring for me now that I'm in the advanced age of 30 or so.
There's a big hangover. It's not that easy to get out of it. If you're a person who has any feelings or any empathy, and you need bigger doses every time you go back to it, and then you have a tendency to begin to have the sort of scary stuff where it's illicit and you're doing it all kind of, just so you build up the adrenaline so that you can have that huge release. So you realize that you're really going the route of every addict.
And Stanton Peale wrote a book called Love and Addiction that talks about this and describes it in great detail.
Well, this has been a great conversation. Folks, you've been listening to Real Relationship, the book, or at least a conversation about the book with Belden Johnson, Real Relationship, Essential Tools to Help You Go the Distance. Pick it up, read it. There's really valuable information in here from someone who knows whereof he speaks. Thank you so much, Belden.
Thank you, Emma. You can get the book on Amazon.com.
Great. So in rounding out today's show, I'd like to do something a little bit different, but also experiential, I think you'll find. And my wife has been after me to share some of my poetry, much of which has never seen any eyes other than mine. But I think that there's a few of the poems I have that kind of relate to relationships and our connection with others and the world around us. This is one I wrote some time ago. It's called I Invite You Into My World. I invite you into my world. When I share with you my heart, willing to trust, the feeling that suffuses my being, I bring to you a message both old and new. You are a light, meant
to shine forth in this self-imposed darkness. You are a sound, a deep vibration, here to harmonize with me. Feel my rhythm, pulse of energy sweeping in and out, Kali marking time, a syncopated pulse multiplied through time, Shiva's dance, and the birth and the death of all that are alive, the whisper of jasmine in an evening breeze, the squeal of a peekaboo baby, the song of a lark, the smile of a young bride, the pulse of life that beckons us, come near, come near, you are already here. Here, the breath that flows through you, flows through me, uniting us, in spite of the apparent differences. Yes, our differences are many and varied. They are here to outline the form of our oneness. I see you. Here's another one from a long time ago. It's entitled, Maybe. Maybe is a very fickle woman, letting me see her half-hidden smile. Maybe lifting her skirts a few inches. Maybe accidentally unpredictable, aloof, yet with eyes that flash. Promises, maybe. All these years of preparation, deep concentration, desiring, caring. Maybe she will, yes, fickle woman slips away into a shadow, and I hesitate in doubt, in fear. Maybe it's all a waste of time. She is not to be mine, maybe not. Slim possibility, never revealing where or when, maybe. If only I knew she was interested in me, desired me, all would be worth it, maybe. Not fickle woman, what do you want from me? Maybe nothing, my frightened heart answers, maybe. I'm wasting my time. Maybe not, but maybe, if I accept the inevitable truth that she is all I will ever have, maybe, as I have her now, maybe I will have her always, maybe. Fickle woman. Here's one I wrote back in March of 1999. It's called The Visitation. On and on they lumber through the night, sometimes alone, sometimes in groups of twos and threes. The huge, black, rolling wheels staining the earth with black rubber, brilliant eyes, terminally transfix the furry night feeders. Glistening with silver and glass, proudly proclaiming their destinations in capital letters, they slice through the early morning haze. Whizzing past, they spawn little dust tornadoes and blow my hat from my head. One by one at the appointed time and in the appointed place, they line up, shoulder to shoulder, side by side, with a loud hissing sound they sigh. A moment's pause. Then suddenly, without warning, in response to some secret signal, they disgorge their living contents. A multicolored spume retches forth,
As if overflowing from some immense sewer, they surge forth and bunch up at the gate, this unstoppable army of Japanese, American, and English, all colors, all shapes, all sizes, weapons at the ready, each armed with a 35mm automatic rapid-fire black zoom lens. They quickly clamber over the rocks and through the gullies. Greedily they consume the scenery and violate its innocence on high-speed film. Heartlessly, in spite of the signs, stealing the soul of the darker-skinned ones who are there selling beads and trinkets. Meanwhile, underground, there flows a river of green, silver, gold. Money of all shapes and colors flows from pocket to till. And now, signaled by midnight stroke of some unseen alarm, they suddenly turn, regroup, and disappear noiselessly into the diesel behemoths that so recently delivered them. The roar of engines, a cloud of dust, and soon all that is left is a small brown man picking up styrofoam coffee cups, cigarette butts, and little yellow film wrappers. With halting steps, the spirit returns to the land to sit sadly, softly, knowing that soon, with the approaching sunset, will come a new swarm, a new feeding frenzy. A small bird calls out, and the spirit weeps. Well, on that pleasant note, let me suggest if you would like to explore some of the ideas that we've shared on the program, you can do so by going to my website, which is drmiller.com. I'd suggest you look at the video series entitled The Power of the Mind to Heal, and one of those videos is on relationships, and you might also enjoy the program that's called Finding Serenity. Thanks again to our guest from today. If you have any questions, comments, or contributions that you'd like to share, please do so. Join our ongoing conversation at facebook.com/AskDrMiller. Or email me at drmiller@drmiller.com. So until we meet again, take care of yourself and by all means, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.